Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 2:30 panel. We won the lottery. If you haven't caffeinated, I suggest that you do so now. This is typically nap time, but we're going to be lively. We may even open the curtains and let some sun shine in at some point. I'm Claire Kramer Mills. I work at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and it's really my pleasure to be facilitating this panel today. We've got two great panelists who are really experts in the realm of small business finance, and who represent kind of the two parts of the finance world, debt and equity. And you know, they're going to draw some connections between the two, and I think provide some really interesting insights about what we know to be a very kind of dynamic and changing world of small business finance. As you are all well aware, having lived through the financial crisis and the aftermath, you know, Main Street lending has changed a great deal following the crisis. Small business finance needs are acute, as a very recent report from J.P. Morgan Chase Institute has illustrated. I'd encourage you all to check it out. They examined essentially inflows and outflows of their account holders, their small business account holders, and just basically documented volatility and also, frankly, you know, the number of days of cash reserves that a typical small business has. I think 27 was the median number of days. And so that's pretty tight, to put it mildly. So I'll leave you to read the implications that they highlight in that report, but it's hot off the presses as of yesterday. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our panelists and then ask them to introduce themselves and their specific areas of specialty and expertise so that everyone in the room can kind of understand what they can pick their brains about for the remainder of the session. So Ted Zoller is immediately to my left. He is a professor of strategy and entrepreneurship at UNC Chapel Hill. He's also the director of the Center for Entrepreneurial Studies at UNC. I'm a dookie, but we have agreed to get along for this panel.
You'll be better educated.
I'm actually a fan of UNC. I really am. I think
I'm a fan of Duke's best.
Yeah. So look, there's a lot of love here. And to his left is Braden McCarthy, who is currently the VP of Strategy at Fundera, which is a really interesting platform that essentially is a matchmaker between lenders and borrowers. And so in a past life, he has worked at the National Economic Council, is that right? And SBA, and co-authored a pretty awesome paper on small business finance with Karen Mills, the former SBA administrator. And he tells us that they are updating that paper now, which is super exciting for all the small business finance nerds here. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Braden to come up and talk about his current job, his responsibilities, you know, why platforms like Fundera exist and what they're hoping to achieve, as well as kind of, you know, just familiarizing all of you with his areas of expertise. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Claire. It's good to be here with you guys. I am going to make this interactive, so if folks have questions as I go, feel free. In terms of areas of expertise, I'm not a banker. I spent 4 years in investment banking on Wall Street before I moved over to the White House, but I'm really more of a policy guy, and that's what I focus on at Fundera. A lot of my focus is how we can make our platform more responsive to borrowers from a customer experience perspective, how we can disclose products and disclose the price of product in particular in a way that a borrower genuinely understands, and I do emphasize the word genuinely understands. But in terms of Fundera, before getting to all that, so Fundera is an online marketplace that seeks to connect borrowers with loans, small businesses in particular. So Fundera started in about 2014. We're funded from a lot of the same venture capitalists behind Uber and Airbnb, with about $15 million in venture capital from Khosla, First Round, Susquehanna, and a few others. In terms of kind of success to date, Fundera has connected 210 million $1 billion worth of loans with small businesses. There are about 60,000 businesses that have used the tool. And on the site, you have SBA product, which represents about a third of overall volume. That's from the likes of Live Oak, from Celtic Bank, and from SmartBiz, which is a kind of a leader in the sub 150K category of SBA lending. You also have within the medium-term lending category a lot of online lenders, Lending Club, Funding Circle, Foundation, Bond Street, DealStruck, names I'm sure you're familiar with. These are lenders that tend to operate with 1 to 3 year term loans that can span anywhere from $75,000 all the way up to $500,000, with rates that can vary anywhere from 7% all the way up to about 28%. That represents about another third of the platform. About another quarter to a third, depending upon how you look at it, either from a units basis or from a volume basis, I tend to from a volume basis, is short-term lending. And that's the likes of OnDeck, Can Capital, Cabbage, Rapid Advance, and others. These tend to be daily debit products, daily ACH. They come with much higher interest rates. They do a lot less underwriting, which is part of the reason why the interest rates are much higher. Those rates can vary anywhere from 20% all the way up to 50% plus. And I'll go through, once we get into more detail on some of these topics, some charts that we have which kind of show how eligibility breaks out, how APR breaks out based off of credit score and revenue on a product-by-product basis. The rest of the platform is business charge cards, business credit cards from the likes of American Express and Chase, lines of credit, equipment leasing. There's a chart that's further in, which we can cover a little later, but just lays out the 14 different types of product that small businesses have from a credit perspective. It's, I dare say, a lot more complicated than the equity side when it comes to finding the right product for your use case. And so what Fundera really tries to do is create a choice architecture in small business lending by helping to educate a borrower about the full range of options that exist in the credit space, understand their kind of gap, their need from a credit perspective, and then help them figure out which option, from charge card to credit card to term loan, line of credit, and the list goes on, makes the most sense for them when they're trying to control for a host of variables. Price, very importantly, speed to funding, the use of proceeds, and the type of repayments, whether it's daily, a monthly, whether it's as a percent of sales, whatever the case might be. So as I said, about $210 million in loans funded to date. It's about 4,400 businesses that have been funded on the platform to date. And so just to kind of underline the point, I mentioned that 60,000 businesses have used the platform. A lot of businesses use the platform just to get a gut check on what options they qualify for. We also offer free business credit score and consumer credit score, so a lot of businesses use the site for that and kind of continue to come back in the same way that you would use Credit Karma in the consumer space for free credit scores. But that is Fundera, and I'm just getting a note to do my slides now. So I'll go through them.
Why not?
Sure.
I'm anxious to see them.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
Click on my name. Okay. Let's see here. Where do I get a?
Right down there, the little icon.
I'm a millennial, and this is complex for me. So
here we go, and then click on that.
Perfect. This is why I use Macs. Perfect. So just to go through, these are the full kind of range of products you'll see on the platform. So as I mentioned, SBA loan, term loan, equipment financing, invoice financing, business lines of credits, short-term loans, cash advances, which represent less than 1% of all products. We tend to find that when borrowers see cash advance products, they tend to think it's just crazy expensive, and if they have other options, they go with those options. Startup loans, business credit cards, and business charge cards, and personal loans from the likes of Prosper, Lending Club, and a few others. This tends to be the startup category in particular. In terms of the full range, so I mentioned some of the names, but this gives you the kind of the full lay of the land across the short term, the medium term, SBA, line of credits, invoice financing, the whole kind of universe. You'll see some names that are familiar to you that are more traditional lenders, and you'll see a lot of online lenders. What we tend to find is that, you know, we're an online platform. If you look at the press, the folks tend to refer to us as the Kayak of small business lending. A lot of borrowers that are going to look for loans online, they expect seamless and glossy user experiences. And what we have found is it's very difficult to integrate with a lot of community banks. It's even difficult to integrate with a lot of regional banks. You see some of the larger banks moving online, Wells, Chase, just being a few examples, where they actually will not just be decisioning borrowers that are within their deposit base, but saying, hey, any borrower who doesn't work with Chase currently, you can come online if you're a business, and you can use Chase QuickPay. I know currently that is that it's only for Chase customers, but the goal, from what I understand, is to launch that out more broadly within the next year. So this is what I was referring to in terms of how eligibility and APR vary. So you can kind of see, it's a little harder given the, is there a way to back up? I'm assuming not. All right, well, I'll just help you. So the very top is short-term loans, short-term line of credits, medium-term loans, medium-term line of credits, SBA loan. And so you can see this is credit score, this is revenue, and this is the APR ranges. So you can see the short-term loans and short-term lines of credit tend to be for the range is wide, but they tend to be for borrowers that are near subprime to near prime in terms of the majority of folks who are going for that product. And they bear higher APRs because of it, anywhere from, as I said, 30 to 50% plus. The average tends to be about 45%. If you were to break down on a volume basis, the overall average APR on Fundera's platform is about 28%. But again, that's because SBA medium-term loans, which bear lower APRs, represent more than two-thirds of overall volume on the platform. But I show this, it's a little harder to tell from here, but the biggest takeaway is that for a lot of borrowers, especially those with credit scores sub 650 and revenue sub a million, the only products they really qualify for are shorter-term products. And so when you look at the types of customers that banks want to fund, they're not in that category. If you look at, since the financial crisis, lending to small businesses, and you break it out, the issues associated with it on a cyclical and on a structural basis, take the cyclical aside, we went through a financial crisis, banks tend to retract during a financial crisis. Just isolate the structural issues, and a lot of banks will say, and I'm curious to hear if folks agree, that the transaction costs associated with doing $1 million loan or a $5 million loan are roughly the same as they are for a $500,000 or $150,000 loan. And so because of that, because it's less profitable to make loans that are sub 500 and certainly sub 150, that's one of the reasons why if you look at broader data on bank lending to small businesses, you see a much bigger decline post the financial crisis in loans sub 150K than you do see in loans sub a million. So when we looked at this with Karen a couple years ago, it was since the kind of pre-crisis peak, overall lending to small businesses was down about 20%, and it was about 24% for loans that were sub 150K. It's come up since then, and this is based off of FDIC call report data, but not dramatically. And I think it is because a lot of banks find it difficult to make these loans. I remember one very heated conversation with Gene Sperling, my old boss, at NEC, and Jamie Dimon, where Jamie Dimon said, look, a widget company makes widgets, a bank makes loans. If we could make money on loans to small businesses, we'd be making more loans to small businesses. We make loans that we can actually fund profitably, and that we can do so with a reasonable degree of certainty that our charge-off rates will stay where they are. So don't push us to make more loans. If you're pushing us to make more loans, we're making loans to less credit-worthy borrowers. And we know that far better than the government does. And I have a lot of sympathy for that point of view. I don't want to take up too much more time, but we can get to some of the other slides that we have in here about the Fundera platform as well as about eligibility, but that should give you the lay of the land for now.
Thanks.
All right. So it's kind of funny, that guy who proclaims himself not a banker isn't wearing a tie, and I'm a professor and I'm wearing a tie. I don't get it. I absolutely made a mistake. I'm kind of an odd duck because, I've been an entrepreneur for most of my life. I've built five businesses. Three were organic growth kind of cash flow businesses, and two were equity-backed businesses. And You know, I really see entrepreneurship as a tool to open opportunity to society and to bring opportunities to everyone. And a lot of our financial structures haven't been set up to democratize opportunity. So, you know, a lot of my work has been focused specifically on opening equity and ultimately broadening the impact of equity in the marketplace to support entrepreneurs. So I guess I'd be an entrepreneurially friendly kind of investor type. I've also been very engaged in work around understanding the nature of syndication and understanding the due diligence process and understanding the really the basis of trust that has to ultimately unfold in the equity markets for money to flow. And I think we've been through two acid tests in the last decade on the stress of the market on equity. And I think that same stress has probably been reflected in debt. And I think in a lot of ways, we, Brayden and I, represent a very nice complement because what does equity want? Equity wants multiple or growth, and equity wants leverage. And leverage comes from access to debt. And unlike, you know, the private equity folks that you might read about in the papers, like the Blackstones and the you know, Black Rocks and the like, anything with black in some kind of hard object, I guess. You know, believe it or not, there are many, many folks sub-mezzanine that are doing really good work in trying to provide equity to small business and making opportunity available to folks. And these are your seed investors, your angel investors, your responsible venture capitalists. You know, I'm not one of these people that lionizes venture capital. Venture capital has a place in the marketplace, but it's not the solution. If anyone thinks that VC is the solution to kind of build our economy, I think they should look at the data as to the number of deals they do and the size of that asset class. And frankly, there's not enough innovation in equity. So I'm very excited about some of the things that are happening now. A lot of people are kind of trumpeting the Jobs Act and the Title III legislation as, you know, a train wreck ready to happen. And I think the opposite. I honestly think that this is an experiment we must take in order to grow our economy and create opportunity well outside the accredited investor framework that I think make, by definition, the rich richer. So I'm all about trying to democratize opportunity based on what do you got? What are you going to go build? So I spend my day job kind of developing an ecosystem of entrepreneurs. And we've built a really high-powered ecosystem in North Carolina in the Research Triangle Park. And my team actually builds everything from early ideation to late-stage acceleration. We built a design lab called 1789, which is basically a clubhouse for entrepreneurs where they can go hack on problems with serial entrepreneurs and get smarter faster. The idea is you learn more quickly. And then we have an acceleration program called Launch Chapel Hill, which has just been ranked in the top three accelerators in North America in terms of outcomes of fundable events and exits because of the strength of the entrepreneurs there. It's, you know, it's an inner network of people. And then we have a very novel apprenticeship where we identify talent graduating from the University of North Carolina, and we follow them for 10 years after they graduate to enhance their transition to entrepreneurship. And as you know, UNC is the, you know, we like to tout ourselves as, the, unlike our friends at Duke, I'm just kidding, no, I love Duke, honestly, I work with Duke all the time, but we talk about ourselves as the University of the People. We were the first public university, and we take that mission pretty seriously by making sure people that have the wherewithal to want to build a business ultimately are given the tools to do that. And for that reason, we have a very aggressive entrepreneurial culture that's, I think, delivered real value on the ground level. You know, I'm not talking about Silicon Valley. I'm talking about Main Street. I'm talking about around the corner. I'm talking about the everyday entrepreneurs who are under-celebrated in life. I mean, you all probably spent all your lives being surrounded by entrepreneurs that really make a difference every day. And these are not the people you're going to see on the cover of Forbes, you know. These are the people that really make a difference. I'm going to share with you just a provocative little kind of example of how you can turn a region into something that's more of a powerhouse. I've been really curious about how do you design high-performance entrepreneurial networks. And I've done some research on kind of the characteristics of those networks. And then we've set in motion a real experiment to see if we could build one. So a lot of us are from regions that underperform. You know, I walked this morning, I got up early this morning and walked around Society Hill. And how many of you are from Philadelphia? Yeah. I mean, what a great city. I mean, the city's got a great heart. It's got a great backbone. It's got a real flavor. It's got a real culture. What's ironic is, did you know that Society Hill, just as an example, wasn't named Society Hill in the original days? It sounds like, you know, highfalutin kind of place, but it was Society's Hill. It was actually the product of a private entity that did trading, and they just happened to own the land in this area of Philadelphia, and they developed the first property here. So this it was I can't remember the name of the organization, but it was a society, much like one of the trading companies. The reason I mention that is, how do you motivate a place like this? Underperforming regions, and I'm not suggesting Philadelphia is an underperforming region, but I think probably you've unrealized potential. And how do you realize your full potential? How do you take your region to the highest level so that we're no longer, I'm so sick of talking about Silicon Valley. I can barf every time I think about Silicon Valley. I'm just tired of it. I want to see places like Philly or places like Raleigh or places like Richmond or places like, you know, Pittsburgh thrive. And that's why I'm kind of here. I'm excited to be here, by the way. So, you know, the other thing I got to tell you, I'm probably going to get thrown out of here. If we got one of those MacArthur geniuses in here, I'm really screwed. But one of the things that I've run into is, you know, I love Michael Porter, but I got to tell you, it's not a terribly useful, actionable methodology when you actually try to do ground-level stuff. The cluster-based theory, it tells you the nature of industry and how firms are internetworked and the competencies of a region, but what do you do with it? And I got really interested in these ideas of how do you merge social capital concepts and clusters. So when you think about the network of the B2B networks that operate in any market, how do they work? How are people connected? How does money flow? I was really interested in that topic. So I wanted to update kind of cluster theory. And basically, I'm trying to answer the question, who's the who? And I came up with this really interesting insight, and, you know, and I can't come up with a better word. Here I am talking about democratizing opportunity, and I use the word deal maker immediately. I'm thinking of some swarmy guy in New York. But, you know, so help me out with a better name. But I found people who were catalysts for business, you know, in the marketplace. And these are people who broker resources, and they usually broker, ultimately, insights. They shape deal networks. They actually help transact activity in that market, and they syndicate, and they interconnect. They ultimately make things happen. They're kind of the glue. And it was ironic that not every entrepreneur is created equal. A lot of people say, we should just create a whole bunch of entrepreneurs. And my work has shown that it's necessary but not sufficient to create a vibrant economy. You have to actually uncover the people who are unlocking opportunity. And these are the people that motivate the marketplace. Hopefully it'll be democratized in our lifetime, but right now it ain't. So you can think about deal makers as an individual maybe at the center, and they activate the rest of the network. So you might think of this person as a serial entrepreneur, and they're connected to others who are first-time entrepreneurs or second-time entrepreneurs. How do you motivate those people? And I looked at a lot of underperforming regions. Each of these regions had large infusions of federal money as a way to stimulate the innovation-based economy and take those innovations to the market, right? So most of the federal research money goes to these regions. There are 12 regions. Then I used Boston and Silicon Valley as our reference regions because they're seen as kind of the leading regions. And ironically, Silicon Valley created over a 20-year period about 5,000 firms. Boston created about 2,200 firms. All these other regions created less than 1,000, half of what Boston did. Many of them are more populous. And my region, Research Triangle Park, which, by the way, has the highest density of PhDs per capita of anywhere in the country, produced the nadir, actually the bottom of the frequency. So it suggested to me, I don't know, maybe it means more professors, less business, you know, so kill the professors after the lawyers, I guess. I don't know what it is. But at any rate, it's going to be important that you recognize there's something else going on in these underperforming regions. So then I looked at the social capital structure, and these are the number of connections. And what I found was when there was vibrancy, you saw what I call a fat base, a lot of connections at the 1 degree level. But the most high-performing regions had what I would also call the long tail, lots of connections among serial entrepreneurs, people who have done business again and again and again and again. Well, let me light this up for you in a really interesting way.
Just one quick clarification. How are you defining connections?
Okay, so these are the number of actual investments.
Okay.
So we're actually looking at transactions.
Okay.
And in a place like Silicon Valley, they have 22,000 serial entrepreneurs interacting, but they have hundreds of serial entrepreneurs. first-time entrepreneurs, 22,000, many, many serial entrepreneurs. But a place like Research Triangle Park, it's pretty weak as it relates to serial entrepreneurship. You don't have that tradition. Then I looked at the nature of these networks, and I drew them. And I call Silicon Valley the black hole. This is organized by population. So this is the most populous, Boston. This is the least populous, Austin. If it varied by population, you'd expect to see the most dense to the least dense, correct? Well, what you see is Boston is the second most dense. Silicon Valley is by far the most dense and is usually about 8 times that of any other region. Then the third largest population, Phoenix, is the weakest network in the marketplace. I showed this to the chancellor at Arizona State University, Michael Crow, who was a real go-getter. He said, Zoller, how many people are up there? And I said, no, about 250 people. And he said, I'm just going to have them over to the house and ask them what the problem is. And he literally had them over to his house. It was kind of crazy. If you're betting based on density, we keep on hearing about density. I'm so tired of hearing about density. And it means that we just have to get more people doing stuff. And I think that's true. But I don't think that's the way to get it done. You would bet on Seattle and San Diego being the next big regions that are going to take off. I think that's probably true. But look at this. When we screen these aggregate networks for deal makers, people who have done 3 or more equity transactions in their life, 3 companies or more, look what happens. You still have a black hole in Silicon Valley. You have a pretty fragmented market in Boston, but you've got handfuls of deal makers in all the other regions. When you go to 4+ equity positions, look at this. You literally have, you could put many of the cities in this room, the people that are doing those kind of business. You still have Silicon Valley as a powerhouse. 86.6% of all serial entrepreneurs are connected within 1 degree of separation in Silicon Valley. That means if I want to talk to you, I just have to talk to him 86% of the time if I'm in Silicon Valley. The second best region, Boston, 56% of the time. Most of these other regions in the 30s. So it gives you a sense that not all regions are created equal. So this is another parlor trick I do called component analysis, and it talks about the fragmentation in a region. Like Orange County, Southern California, I'm doing some work there now. It is a basket case. They've got 5 different kind of communities of entrepreneurs and a whole bunch of folks that do business outside of Orange County. Their goal is to increase cohesiveness. I hope I'm not going over my time. Am I okay? I'm going to roll now. Right. So just let me go. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to conclude. I'm going to conclude with an experiment because I got really interested in this, and I convinced, you know, one of those black hard things to give me some money. Blackstone has a beautiful charitable foundation, and I thought it was justice to kind of pull that money and do some good with it. So I grabbed it, and I did some good with it. What we did is we said, okay, can we motivate vibrancy in an underperforming region? What's an underperforming region? Research Triangle Park. Why don't we try this out? So we appointed 20 serial entrepreneurs, and we identified them using the data approach we use. These are the serial entrepreneurs, and we gave them a badge. We literally said, just reverse your lapel. We're going to give you a little pin, and you now are appointed as the talent agent for the region. Your job is to help young entrepreneurs get connected in big ways to leapfrog over other things, right? Get them to learn faster. They're like, no one's ever asked me to do that. Well, we don't ask them to do it. That's stupid, isn't it? We should ask them to have a job. So what we did is I mapped this effect, and we appointed these 20 people, and it had effect all over the region. What does this graphic mean? This is the B2B connections in the region. The colored ones are the ones that were affected by our network. The circles are the big investors, and the triangles are the big entrepreneurs. And the connection, it means they're investing in one another. Well, so if you zoom in, these are people and companies, right? The circles, an investor like this guy, Richard Katz, Kay Wagner, a big entrepreneur, and the company that they invested in together, Ipagen, right? So we started looking at this, and we started with this network of things. We wanted to increase the performance of this economy. So we appointed the 20 people. So these are the people that were initially appointed, the 7 or 8 people we appointed. 1 big mega investor, 2 other investors, and then 5 serial entrepreneurs. We said, okay, go to work. Well, those people propagated to enhance the network, and these are the effects they had directly by using their own networks to start influencing the quality of the network performance. And then they, on a second degree basis, connected to those people who then had effect on those companies and investments. So with 20 people, we had this much penetration in our economy on influencing the nature of the entrepreneurial network. And what that means is, and you notice that the centrality, this center point in the network, and the size of those icons, the more coverage with those people, the more likely businesses will be done in a higher velocity. So as a result, after this experiment, investments have gone up by double. The number of transactions have tripled, and we've actually had extraordinary exit results. So just by engaging and giving these investors a job, and these entrepreneurs a job, it actually had an amazing direct impact on the nature of business in this secondary region. Here's another example of the type of activity. We actually asked them what they specifically did, and we tracked it in a database. And this was the initial set of connections that occurred. And within 1 year, they were connected like this. So it gives you a sense that there's much more. This is more of a sense of centrality, or there's more activity occurring among some of the players. So it gives you a sense of what we're doing. So we're learning, you know, how do we implement vibrancy in a network? I just wanted to expose that to you just to give you a sense, just to conclude real quick. I think you can actually help to shape equity networks intentionally. I believe that you identify the people that do it and then make them your champions and give them a job. You have to put a face on what I would call cluster analysis to facilitate the development of equity networks, and then think about how those networks are connected in various industries, life sciences, tech, engineering, manufacturing, services, retail, consumer discretionary, whatever. And then link those complementary networks throughout the U.S. If I could find unlimited resources, I would try to do this in every city and then connect the cities, because that will just feed the crowdfunding and crowdsourcing opportunities we might have in the future, and we really can democratize entrepreneurship. So there you go. That's all I got.
Well, thanks. Thank you.
I don't know if my mic is on, so I'm just going to stand up and pitch questions at you both for a quick second. So I'm going to try to channel maybe some of the questions that folks in the audience have, and I'm not going to monopolize the time because I know that a lot of you have your own questions, undoubtedly. But just to follow up first on Ted, and then I'll turn to you, Braden, because I have a lot of questions about what you're doing and what you're finding, the intelligence that you have. So you've demonstrated, Ted, that there's this relationship between networks, density of networks, and deals. But you also happen to be illustrating why this matters in a region that you yourself sort of said is if you shake a tree, you're going to, you know, PhDs will fall. So there are other facilitating conditions that were clearly apparent in the greater RTP area. So I'm wondering, for other cities that you labeled as underperforming, what other facilitating conditions might actually need to be present in addition to bolstering the networks?
So one of the things that I've clearly identified is you have to look where your competence is, where there's activity already occurring, and who are the leaders behind that competency. So let's say you might be in a manufacturing area where they're doing intermediate supply chain. Look specifically at the entrepreneurs that are doing that work and engage them, and try to figure out what barriers are they facing to continue to grow, to continue to employ, to continue to invest, and open those barriers as best you can. I think the mayors, for instance, that we just heard at lunchtime understand economic vibrancy, and I think the public sector and the private sector have a lot of tools to bear on making the conditions available. I also think, you know, what we're learning is the milieu. The environment is pretty quite important. I see these innovation districts or what have you coming up. I think what you're seeing is, you know, a marketplace that's more networked, where collisions occur between entrepreneurs who are trying to do things and investors who want to invest in those things, and then ultimately the employees that make it happen. So, we're creating greater vibrancy, and I think, you know, I'm seeing with the web is engaging the city, and the city, the metros are starting to become kind of a tool of progress and performance in entrepreneurship. So I'm really bullish about, the secondary regions of the world.
I also wanted to touch very briefly, you had addressed the Jobs Act and crowdfunding and the potential now for unaccredited investors to become investors in small businesses. Clearly, you know, that presents opportunity for business owners. Many of us have probably participated in a GoFundMe or other campaign, or at least you're aware of the Pebble Watch story or other burgeoning efforts. But you know, what are the risks? To your mind, because they're not small.
So Brayton owns a big piece of crowdfunding, and she should also jump in here.
Yeah.
I want to just define a couple terms. There are several types of crowdfunding or crowdsourcing vehicles. There's reward-based, like Kickstarter or Indiegogo. Yeah. There's equity-based, which is now, because of the Title III, opening up in a massive way, becoming a marketplace. There's debt-based, that Fundera plays in, and then donation-based, like Kickstarter, like Kiva and Donors Choose and others like that. And all of them represent allocating funding to some worthy project. The degree of worthiness is a function of what I would argue due diligence. And the more transparent the data is in terms of what the risks are in that investment, whether it be a donation or some kind of reward-based approach, non-equity, or an equity investment, is a function of the degree of risk based on the business case. So the more transparent we can make the business case, recognizing in an early stage venture, you really don't see more than 6 months out in the future, the better the investor is going to be to allocate their money to the causes and the investment opportunities that they most care about. I've been disappointed by many entrepreneurs who just don't know how to manage, and that's what my job is as an everyday kind of person at the university, is to help entrepreneurs know how to build the business case that can be communicated to a third party so that funds flow and investments are made.
You know, Brayton, I don't know if you want to jump in here.
Yeah, no, so in reference to the debt side, and specifically online lending, I kind of think about the risks in three big buckets. The first is systemic risk to the kind of the broader banking system. The second is around borrower protection, which I think is the most important. And the third is around investor protection. So I'll deal with the systemic risk first. I mean, for all the money and mindshare that online lending captures on both coasts, and especially in Silicon Valley, if you look at loans on the balance sheets of banks, community banks, regional banks, large banks, and you just look at C&I, that's about $298 billion in loans to small businesses. If you look at all lending done online to small businesses, it doesn't even hit $10 billion. So, I mean, folks talk about this industry as if it is transforming online, or transforming lending, period. And there's no question there's a lot of power and potential for that to happen eventually. And some estimates, Morgan Stanley and Goldman have both done theirs, and they say that online lending could constitute anywhere from 15% to 20%, depending upon which report you go off of all lending to small businesses by 2025. So no question it's growing fast, but it's still quite small today. And so in terms of the risk it poses to the system, I'm not really buying it just yet. But in terms of borrower protection, I think the risk is significant. If you look at the level of regulatory architecture we have, TILA, ACOA, Fair Debt Collection, you don't have the same level of architecture in the small business space as you do in the consumer space. And that's in part because regulators have tended to be biased to the view that small businesses or businesses don't need, they are more sophisticated borrowers and don't need the level of oversight and transparent disclosures that consumers do. And generally, as a baseline, I would buy that. But when you look at those who are going online, they tend to be looking for loans that are 20K, 50K, 100K. Certainly sub 200,000. And those borrowers have a lot more in common with an everyday consumer than they do with GE and Walmart. And so when you compare the lack of regulatory oversight, the lack of a need to disclose things like APRs, monthly and daily repayment, prepayment penalties in terms of borrower can understand, and you compare that lack of disclosure with this relatively unsophisticated borrower set, you can see how a lot of borrowers could wind up in products they don't understand, genuinely understand, and can't reasonably repay. And so I think that's something that regulators at a state or federal level need to look at more closely, and I'm happy to talk about more ideas that we put forward along those lines. On the investor risk side, you know, I mean, you have, I think you have to look at how a lot of these online lenders are actually sourcing their capital. Unlike banks, they don't have retail footprints. That's a competitive advantage in some respects because it lowers their cost to fund, but it's also a competitive disadvantage in other ways because they have to go out and find capital from hedge funds, from pension funds, from institutional investors who do expect a very high return. And as rates go up from the Fed, you know, we'll find out this week that returns are only going to go up that they are requiring. And so that cost of capital can be significant for these guys. I think what you have to ensure is there is alignment of risk from those who are actually making the loans, as in those who are decisioning, a lending club and a funding circle, for example, and those who they are placing borrowers' loans with. Because that investor is relying entirely on lending club, entirely on funding circle, entirely on OnDeck to do that underwriting. And assuming that they, you know, that the credit box they pick that borrower to go apart to go in, and the financing charge they associate with that is commensurate with the risk posed by that borrower. And I think while that's all well and good, no player has lent through a crisis. And the only way you can test credit boxes and credit models is actually understanding what happens when, you know, revenue goes down, cash flow goes down, there's a recession that happens, and those who you thought were qualified creditworthy borrowers 2 years ago are now no longer. And I think that is, you know, a challenge within the industry.
Thank you. So you made the point earlier, I guess, about the conversation that you had with between Gene Sperling and Jamie Dimon in the thick of the crisis. But, you know, I think the point holds even more broadly, right? You know, the Fed's research, the small business survey that we've been doing for the last couple of years, when we ask about borrower financing needs, credit needs, you know, a square, you know, I would say 50% are really seeking $250,000 or under in financing. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense because most small businesses are in fact small. But that speaks to sophistication levels. It speaks mm-hmm. to comprehension levels. It also speaks to, in some cases, you know, if you take that fact with the Chase Institute's finding about cash flow challenges and smoothing challenges, which we also consistently find reported by businesses. Cash flow is a big deal, and smoothing it is a big deal. You know, how do you square that with the available product set, first mm-hmm. of all? And then also, how do you square that with really the disclosures and the kind of the navigation aids that a typical business might need? I know you're doing some interesting work in this space. Yeah. So I'd love to hear, and I think we would all love to hear that.
I mean, bottom line, I think there are a lot of small business owners that are out there that are getting in products that they are too expensive for them. They are getting into products that, so this happens all the time at Fundera, where a borrower will come with an offer from a short-term lender and say, hey, this is the option I have. What else can you guys get me? This feels a little expensive. And they'll fill out the common application, we'll run the matching logic, we'll see the full range of options they see, and we have a match page that this is fully transparent to them. They'll see the match page across all different credit products they qualify for, and sure enough, they don't qualify, or they do qualify for an 84% interest rate loan, but they also qualify for a median term loan that comes with a 22% interest rate. And they also could qualify for an SBA loan. In some cases, so that's fewer and further between, especially if you're looking online. So I think the biggest issue that we have found in lending, but especially borrowers who are going online, is in a world in which competitors can say whatever they want about their product, even if it happens to be untrue, you find a lot of borrowers who don't know any better. I know what my mortgage rate should be. Most people here know what their mortgage rate should be within ballpark ranges when you go to a bank and you're looking to buy a house. But small business owners don't know what interest rate they deserve or should get when they are looking for credit. And it's understandable given the heterogeneity of the small business population, but also the complexity of the product relative to the use case. A charge card, for example, is super helpful to kind of run everyday expenses. So thanks, Amex, but not as helpful when you want to actually pay your workers. And that's why a cash flow product or a term loan can make more sense in certain cases. So I think generally speaking, what we are trying to do is, in the same way that Ted's talking about democratizing access to information and to networks, democratizing access to information about products and democratizing access to information, not just information, but application processes to products, such that, and this is referencing Claire's work, but if you look at regional Fed surveys that talk about the number of hours that it takes a borrower to go from bank to bank to bank, to fill out application material, to submit documentation to support that application material, and then wait and pray that banker can support, can fund their business, it can be anywhere from 24 to 72 full man hours. That's weeks of work that borrower would have spent going to 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe even more different banks. And I'm not saying that that isn't a good process. It helps to call out those who are serious from those who don't have intent. But I think we can do better than that in an age where if I want to find a flight, I don't go to American Airlines first. I go to Kayak first, and I want to understand the options I have before I choose it. And I think, no question, finding a loan is far more complicated than finding a flight and choosing an airline. No question. But I think the benefit of the internet is it is supposed to democratize access to information. It is supposed to democratize access to those who actually understand how to compare these products. And so what we need to do is support platforms like Fundera that are trying to help borrowers find the best loan for them, as opposed to push that borrower to one product as a one-size-fits-all, because that happens to help my bottom line. Again, no prejudice against a lender that tries to do that. That is the nature of an arm's-length transaction. But when you're talking about brokers and you're talking about online brokers, you have a fiduciary responsibility, we think, to that borrower to act in their best interest.
Thanks. So I don't want to monopolize you two any further. We're going to open it up to everyone. This is a great audience. So we want to make sure that we have enough time to have a discussion. So just shoot up, stand up when you have a question, or raise your hand, and then I'll just point. So you're first. And if you could just give your name and your institution, that would be terrific. Thanks.
My name is Mike Schwartz. I'm with the Kayfords Foundation in Washington, D.C. So I'm curious, what is the role, if any, of CDFIs in this? And mm-hmm. What about the role of nonprofits? Mm-hmm. And then what is the role of funders like the Kayfords Foundation?
Sure. I'll talk about it from the lending perspective. So, I mean, between us, so we are launching a partnership with a range of CDFIs, about four CDFIs across the country, which we'll be able to lend to California, Washington State, New York, and Texas, to bring them onto the platform to help them find borrowers within their states. The biggest challenge that we have found with bringing CDFIs onto the platform is twofold. One, the geographic focus. We are an online site that has helped borrowers secure loans in all 50 states. And no question, I mean, when you look at U.S. GDP and you look at overall lending on a volume basis, not all states are created equal. And the same is true on our site. So 8% of all of overall lending on Fundera happens to California, about 6% to New York, and you know the list goes on. But the point being, it becomes very difficult to have a national solution for CDFIs because you're going to need to have 50, 60 plus CDFIs on the platform. We have 30 lenders on the platform right now, and our goal is never to have significantly more than that, because it becomes very difficult to integrate with those lenders to understand the borrowers they want to fund, but also from a technological perspective, it becomes very difficult to pass information back and forth in secure ways if they don't have the capability to do that. And one of the things that we just will not compromise on is all of the matching, all of the disclosure of information about products, including APRs and monthly and daily repayment and the like, as well as all submission of documentation has to happen on Fundera's site. When we first launched, we were more of a Kayak, where you'd claim your offer and you'd move off to OnDeck site or to Lending Club site or to Funding Circle site. And what we found is that borrowers hated the user experience, because we said we were helping to democratize access to information, but really what we were doing is just helping to funnel them to 14 different lenders, and they'd have 12 different screens up on their site trying to make sense of what that lender said. And so we tried to bring it all in-house. And that becomes very difficult with a lot of CDFIs. There is a solution that's out there that helps to digitize the underwriting process. Mirador is just one player, but there are others who are doing this as well. And I think that presents a real opportunity for platforms like ourselves, where you can say, we can build an API, build basically a technical solution to just integrate with that startup, Mirador. And that gives us access to 12 different CDFIs because they run the underwriting process. They help digitize the underwriting process at those CDFIs. And we don't have to ping those applications to 12 different players. We can ping it to one, and then they can direct it to where it needs to go. It's untested. It's a new software. It's been around for about 2 years. But I think that's an interesting solution for folks like ourselves that find it difficult to integrate from a technological perspective with a lot of CDFIs.
Can I just, one quick? So I would just say that when we survey business owners, and we survey both those who have sought capital for their business recently, but those that haven't applied, but might benefit from capital for their business. So those that we call discouraged borrowers, they self-censor out of the market, essentially. They both reference credit score issues, right? Either not having a high enough credit score to qualify, so the problem mm-hmm. that Braden referenced earlier, or not enough of a track record. So when you ask about the role for CDFIs or nonprofits, I would say credit building is huge. And I would say that products that help business owners and frankly, individuals, because every new business basically is relying on personal credit scores anyway.
Mm-hmm. No question.
So I think that's critical.
You know, I was just looking at some of the data just to give you an idea of the relative power of the CDFIs relative to the marketplace. And you know, have you heard about the financial database Preqin? It's like Privco, Capital IQ, CB Insights. They're all really interesting databases. I'm going to give you a perspective for those of you who don't understand the financial structure. You have debt and you have equity. Equity is wealth invested. Debt is expecting a repayment. All private equity, not including venture capital and other forms of seed and angel capital, was about, in 2015, about a $144 billion market. And that's actually very low in relation to what it's done since 2008, roughly. It's gone down quite a lot due to corporatization and so forth. VC is about a $58 billion market last year. And there was a really interesting monograph done by Fortune magazine saying how crowdfunding is overtaking the size of venture capital this year. I don't think that's accurate because the vintage fund structure of a venture capital firm is usually 10 to 12 years. So, you know, it's hard to count the numbers, and VCs aren't very transparent about their numbers. But let's just assume crowdfunding is overtaken in terms of its power on the equity side, all funding side, venture capital. Well, that's not really true either, because within crowdfunding, which is roughly $34 billion, $25 billion of that is debt crowdfunding. So Fundera and the work that's being done there represents, if you were looking at like a planet, that'd be Mars. Whereas equity crowdfunding was only $2.5 billion, so that's Pluto. It's just starting the process. So right now, and CDFIs, by the way, are larger, $64 billion in 2014. I don't know what they did in 2015. I couldn't find the data. But roughly the same size as the impact of venture capital. I would argue that capacity building at the community level is really a critical infrastructural problem. And if philanthropy doesn't fill that hole, no one else will do it. Government is stretching, you know, the extent of what they can do. Philanthropy always looks for sustainability. They want to see, you know, replication, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is the cash is just needed at the ground level for us to grease the skids for the market to do its work. These markets do pick up if you can create that critical mass. So I'd be looking at market uptake as a metric of sustainability as opposed to some kind of return on investment on the capital that philanthropy is investing. I'm not an expert in CDFI, so I can't really speak to that.
Other questions? Comments?
Hi, I'm Charlene Van Dyke with the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and the question I'm about to ask does not represent the Board of Governors or the Federal Reserve System. This question is both for Ted and Braden. I'm wondering, well, your nodes and maps that you put up, Ted, were very fascinating. Got my brain thinking in terms of women and minorities and their access to venture capital, which is widely known that it's fairly limited, around 7% for women and 1% for other minorities, African Americans specifically. I'm wondering if you can talk about maybe if you've done any research on what your nodes would look like if you looked at the connectors using the lens of race or gender. And then for Braden, as a broker, you may be able to collect different data than a lender would. And so do you have any information on people that are using Fundera?
We just released a report to that end, yeah.
Awesome. Braden, why don't you go ahead? Tell about it.
Can I go back?
Yeah, go back.
So it's so timely that you asked that question, because so 2 weeks ago, you may have seen it, Forbes picked it up, but we did the first ever, I think anyway, survey of women business owners, asking them questions about eligibility and the products they want, but also looking at actual data to see how they were funded, and look at revenue, look at average credit scores, look at average APRs, and compare that to male-owned businesses and see how do women fare. And it's I don't think it should surprise anyone that it's actually some fairly depressing stuff. So let me just go to the data. So there's a host of data in here. I'm happy to make it available on millennials, as well as businesses, sole prop versus LLC, and how they break down from a credit perspective. But just going straight to women-owned businesses. What we've found looking at the average credit scores of women-owned businesses that have used Fundera, so this is data from about 8,000 different business owners. We haven't always collected data on gender, in part for fair lending reasons, but you are required to do so at the SBA. And so when we brought the SBA product on, we started collecting it for everyone. So this is a subset of those we actually funded and those who've used the tool. But again, it's about 8,000 businesses. About 3,000 of which were women. And what we found is the average credit scores for women-owned businesses can be about 620 or so, and the average for men is about 640, 650. So it's a pretty significant gap. And what that ends up happening, and then if you combine the kind of smaller credit score that women have with the revenue breakdown, this is the distribution of applicants by annual revenue and gender. And so you'll see female is... or that the orange is female and the blue is male. So you'll see almost across the board, women tend to make about 30% less than male-owned businesses do. And so when you combine lower average credit score, making less money, and this data correlates with broader economic research that say that the average of a female worker makes 79 cents to the dollar, what you have is women-owned businesses tend to be less creditworthy when seeking debt capital. I don't by any means mean to say that this is lenders out, like, you know, that this from a COA perspective is disparate treatment and lenders actively discriminating against women, because the vast majority, with the exception of the SBA lenders on the platform, don't collect this data. But I think what it does show is the broader economic issues that women face in this country, like also filter over into issues that women-owned businesses face in this country, and that then has negative implications for their ability to get debt capital. One really interesting piece from the study that we found is that women-owned businesses, when you control for things like revenue and credit score, they tend to ask for less debt, a smaller loan size. And that would make sense generally when you just look at, well, they make less money, they have a lower credit score, of course they're going to ask for less money. But when you control for things like revenue and credit score, they still ask for less money. And when you look at broader economic data that shows that women tend to ask for wages at a lower frequency than men do, I think there's some correlation there. No question, this is just going off of the past 3 years. No question we've made huge progress in terms of women's access to capital on the equity and debt side over the course of the past 30 years. But I think what this really does show is how much more work we have to do.
A quick follow-up, just a question on that. So if you take, if they may be applying for less, but what are their success? Sorry. Yeah, sure.
I'll steal this. What do their success rates look like, though? So assuming that you have highly qualified women who are in the upper tranches of the revenue brackets and are in the upper tranches of credit scores, is their success rate, they may be asking for smaller denominations, but what does their success rate look compared to the male-owned businesses?
Yeah. Sure. On an overall basis, it is lower, no question. But that's, again, because you're talking about a population that they make less money, their credit scores are lower. So if you just try to control for those things, their success rate is about the same. So again, I think that underscores the fact that lenders are not openly discriminating against women. Though if you start talking about disparate impact as opposed to disparate treatment, that's an open question that I think the Supreme Court's still working through. But I think what it shows even beyond that, though, is that if you look at the average credit score of women-owned businesses and then you compare that to male-owned businesses and you look at millennials, what you see is women-owned businesses that are with the owner that's an age that's lower than 35, I think was our cutoff, it is an even bigger issue. And so that's the case for millennials generally. I mean, this is a generational issue. This is a generation that grew up in the aftermath of the financial crisis. So it's not surprising, but I think it is just compounds the issue because we talk about all the progress we've made, but when you start looking at businesses by age, you see, well, wait, like we think our children, like my generation, should be okay. We've made a lot of progress that our mothers and our grandmothers made, so our generation should be okay. But that gap is even bigger for millennials when you're comparing it on a gender basis, which I think just underscores the nature of the problem.
I can't wait to answer this question. But you were going to contribute something, weren't
no,
you?
No, I wasn't. I had a follow-on question. Yeah. I just wanted to ask
that question. So are there any venture capitalists or investment bankers in the room? Oh, good. Then we can talk about them. You know, no kidding. They're guilty as charged. I want to just tell an anecdote. I was invited to the Future of Venture Capital Conference. It was 50 people in Palm Beach, and it was Sequoia and Accel and Kleiner Perkins and Benchmark and all the big VC firms. You know, this was the, you know, if a bomb went off in the room, probably society would get better. I'm just joking. But, you know, honestly, you would miss venture capital, I guess. What's interesting is I was in the room and my work's about secondary regions and so forth. And one of the VCs from Accel got up and said, you know, I believe our market is perfectly optimized. There's not a dollar of venture capital not going to a worthy project. And there's not a deal that's worth funding that's not getting money. And I was like, I'm not kidding. And then a guy from Sequoia immediately piped up, oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think that every deal that's worth funding is being funded now. And it's almost like a perfectly optimized market. And I couldn't believe that was the prevailing opinion. So I raised my hand and I said, well, you know, I'm from a region, Research Triangle Park, and, you know, I know of many, many worthy deals that aren't getting funded at all. You're not even aware of them. And he goes, oh, no, that's not right. That's absolutely not correct. And I was like, okay, and everyone talked me down. No kidding. It's interesting. Investment banking and private equity and venture capital are pretty heavily weighted toward white men, and it's a structural model. The accredited investor rules, you know, reinforce it a bit, but the training and the culture of those industries, I think, reinforce it a bit. I can't believe I'm saying this openly, but you know, don't attribute that to me. You know, I am a business school professor, by the way. But what's fascinating is it's a marketplace. Investment banking is more evenly distributed female to male, but the attrition rate is much higher. Males remain in the industry, females drop out of the industry. Investment banking is one of the main pathways into venture capital and into private equity. The survivors go into those markets. They're generally white males. And what's interesting is Sally Krawcheck and I are working on a project. Sally is the CEO of Merrill Lynch, or was the CEO of Merrill Lynch, and she came out of investment banking and then did private wealth management, probably most powerful female financial CEO in the country. And she started a new initiative called Elevate, where she's going to identify female leaders to participate in private boards. And we're lighting up all the private board members. But I tell you, the participation of private board members who are females is extraordinarily low. I wish I could speak to race. If anyone knows of a database where I could code, you know, the likelihood of race by name, I could do some really cool stuff on race. But I've not been able to do it. I've done it through, you know, different mechanisms. But I can do female-male pretty easily. What I'm finding is that in different forms of crowdfunding, the gender participation is more equal than it is in venture capital and private equity. It is almost even in debt. In donation-based and reward-based, it's almost completely even. In equity, it's still off-centered, off of an equilibrium toward males. So it's reflecting a little bit more like venture capital, but there's higher participation rates of females in crowdfunding. So this function of democratization, I think, is going to work largely due to cultural mechanisms that I think unfold in the training base, the MBA programs, which are highly weighted toward men, the investment banking kind of hazing ritual that the survivors generally are white males who then go and enter alternative investment classes. So it's a function of the training base and the life cycle of building a career. I think it's a survival-based mechanism. So, you know, it'd be very interesting for us to, you know, open that up a little bit more, and it is a terribly difficult issue to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, as a former investment banker and someone who just finished their MBA about a year ago, generally what I would say, those in my class who left early, especially female bankers, tended to leave because there's a culture of you give everything you have to the firm. And I worked at Goldman and at Lehman Brothers. You give everything you have to the firm. And that becomes a very, very high burden when you start talking about trying to plan for families. And so I think one of the big ways to help democratize access to those jobs and then those that come after from private equity and venture capital is potentially mandating paid family leave, where there's no stigma associated with taking 3 months off or 6 months or however long folks determine, because it is just as common for a male employee as it is for a female employee to do it. I had a whole host of friends that were the main kind of wage earner in their household, and this is a high class problem, but a consultant and a banker, and she may have made more money, but it was more accepted for her to take the 3 months off, so she took the time off, which meant it was more likely that she would stay off. Or that if she came back, there'd be a harder adjustment, even though she was totally willing that her partner take the 3 months off and she continue to work because, again, she was the main wage earner. And there is not that culture of acceptance within the consulting and banking worlds, which, as Ted mentioned, are big feeders for VC to do that. And I think it's a big problem. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of women say, I'm doing this for 2 years and then I'm getting out.
I have another facet building off of this question. My name is Sofia Lopez. I am with NALCAB, the National Association for Latino Community Asset Builders. And we have a membership base that does a lot of work preparing small business owners, Latino small business owners, to access capital. A lot of them self-select out of even seeking financing for a number of reasons. And we've done some research trying to figure out what is actually available to Latinos. And it shouldn't surprise, one of the really big issues is language. And I'm wondering if Fundera has any Spanish language at all?
We do. So we have customer success representatives that absolutely speak Spanish and Chinese.
Awesome.
But the service itself, it's still in English. And it's a problem for us.
Okay.
We're launching a partnership with the New York local chambers of commerce in New York, and it's a requirement for them that the software be in Spanish and be in Chinese, in addition to the customer success representatives that they'd be on the phone with, being able to speak those languages. It's a big burden for a startup that needs to kind of chase scale and size early, but it's an important one, especially as you start to scale. Because otherwise you're locking yourself off from a very large market. There is Camino Financial. It's actually two very close friends of mine from HBS have started up. I don't think of it as a Fundera competitor, but it's very similar to Fundera, and it's exclusively focused on Hispanic-owned businesses. And I believe they've done about $1 million or so in loans to date, so much smaller, but they are exclusively targeting Hispanics, building a site that is entirely in Spanish, and building a customer success team model off of Fundera that is Spanish-speaking. And so I think you know, it's a big order to ask a 2-year-old startup to be able to play in every single market before we've been able to scale in the market that we're in.
Definitely.
But no question, it's important in terms of long-term sustainability of the model.
Awesome. Okay. I appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, I guess our vantage point is definitely knowing that Latinos are a growing share of small business owners. It's one of the, you know, we try to prepare them on the demand side, but are very concerned about supply.
No question.
There's something I'd want to add there that's interesting. Please come on up, sir. I just have a quick point. The diaspora that are in Latin communities is actually very vibrant. I don't know if you follow the Startup Chile experiment, but that's turned into a massive movement of entrepreneurs from Chile. I'm going down to Guatemala in December. There's a massive group of entrepreneurs that are moving there. Colombia is on fire right now. Costa Rica is on fire. Mexico, parts of Mexico are actually recovering their country from, you know, some of the gang activity. I'm working with an Argentinian network and a Brazilian network. So, and believe it or not, even an Uruguayan network, which is, you know, if you've ever been to Uruguay, you know how backwards it is. So I would also break Latino down to the countries of origin and their diaspora.
Tony Letta, I'm the director for the Eastern Region for the Small Business Administration here in Pennsylvania. And I'm just curious, Braden, from your portfolio perspective, although you don't have a huge SBA portfolio, haven't been doing it that long, is the demographic in terms of industry or loan size or just the general demographic much different than that of the national SBA demographics? And also, for those SBA lenders that you have, is the Fundera demographic different than their other SBA portfolio demographic?
I can't speak to the last part of the question, but I can to the first part. If you look at the average loan size of the SBA, and I think it's a big problem post-financial crisis, it's gone up to about $350,000. And that's in part because through the Small Business Jobs Act and through the Recovery Act, we pushed the ceiling from about about $2 million to $5 million. That an SBA loan could qualify for, and that's all well and good, and it's what a lot of banks wanted. But I think, simultaneous to that happening, you also had increased capital requirements through Basel III and through Dodd-Frank, which have meant that a lot of banks, I think, are using SBA to make loans they otherwise would have made in a different world. And they are doing that because if you have a 50% all the way up to a 90% guarantee on the SBA loan you're making, you only have to hold the non-guaranteed portion, capital on your balance sheet against the non-guaranteed portion. You don't on the SBA guaranteed portion. And more often than not, you're probably selling that loan in the secondary market because SBA lending is the only secondary market of scale in small business lending. So I say that to say that if you look at the average size of SBA lending pre-crisis, it was $150,000. It's now closer to $350,000. And I think it shows the unintended consequences of things like increased capital requirements when you also want to make sure that banks are actually lending to small businesses, given that those tend to be the cheapest product available from a term loan perspective, certainly to small businesses. But I say that mostly to say that if you look at the average loan size of SBA, and you look at the industry breakdown, what you see at Fundera is the average loan size is dramatically lower. So we can go from 2,500, which tends to be more of a personal loan or a startup loan, all the way up to 5 million. But the largest we've ever funded on the platform was an SBA loan, and that was for 2 million. But the average SBA loan on our platform is about 175,000. So dramatically lower than it is for the national average. If you look at what it is for the lenders that are on the platform, Celtic, SmartBiz, Live Oak, I don't fully know what their averages are. I think it's relatively consistent. These tend to be the guys that play in the sub 150 or so category of SBA lending. But I do know, I mean, one of the things that's been very difficult in terms of bringing SBA product onto the platform is if you look at those who have really innovated in SBA lending in the sub kind of 150 to 200K category, Live Oak is certainly one of them. And it has been for several years running now, one of the top five largest lenders in the SBA sub 150. But they only lend to, I think it's 14 different verticals. And so it's been very difficult because there aren't a lot of players like Live Oak that can go national, that can lend to every industry. And so it does mean that when you look at the industry breakdown, there are a lot of borrowers who might qualify for an SBA loan if they're looking for a larger loan size and had a bigger business, but we don't have a lender that can fund them. And Live Oak only works in 14 verticals, and so it means that there's more concentration in the SBA product on our platform than there is off. But the medium-term product from Lending Club, Funding Circle, Foundation, DealStruck, Bond Street is actually fairly competitive with the SBA. So I have the chart, but it's deeper in. And again, I'm happy to send this around. If you look at kind of time to funding and then APR, what you see is time to funding and APR tend to be kind of inversely correlated, which makes sense. If you're doing less underwriting and you're getting the money more quickly, then the lender is going to ask for more money from a rate perspective. But the point of the chart is if you look at SBA lending, the average time to funding for SBA, even on our platform, is about 42 days. It's 42 days. And sure, that comes with a rate of 7 to 10% interest rate, and that's great because it's small, and they do very large loan sizes if you have the credit profile for it. But when you compare that 42 days to 5 days from a Lending Club, a Funding Circle, a Foundation, or a DealStruck with rates that can vary from 12 to 28%. You start to say, if you're a borrower, well, a bird in the hand, like, I don't know if SBA is going to come back with a loan that actually makes sense for me. I don't even know if I'm going to getting it approved. But I do know the average time to funding is 42 days versus 5 to 7 days. And that rate differential isn't that dramatic when you include that kind of time issue. So I think it's a real problem for the SBA. It's a real problem for small business lending generally, because a lot of borrowers, especially when you have rates that are as low as that, say, I know it's more expensive, but I have certainty of financing and I can get the money in 5 to 7 days. I'll go with that option.
I'm Kathy Sneed. I live here in Philadelphia. I have a couple questions for Ted. I was just curious, when you did your clusters and you identified serial entrepreneurs, how you compensated them. And the other question I had, I think you made reference to not all entrepreneurs being equal. I was just curious about what you look for in an entrepreneur and what you think makes an entrepreneur successful.
Right.
Good question. When you say compensate, do you mean in order to get their data? Or do you mean...
Oh, yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah. Yeah. So we initially offered them a stipend, and most of them turned it down. Yeah. We offered them $10,000 or something, and they were like, I don't need it. Most of them have the money that they didn't need it. And they were thrilled to be asked to do something. You know, most of them are playing golf or doing some other deal that probably they're half-heartedly in because they want to just have something to do. And this gives them something to do. You wouldn't believe how much human capital qualified people are just wandering around doing nothing. I'm a big fan, by the way, of the Service Corps of Retired Executives. So we have an amazing chapter in Chapel Hill. And they're not just the old codgers that are just out there being cranky. I mean, some of them are the C-level people from, you know, we have the C-level people from Miller Beer, from the Body Shop. I just would, someone was from the SBA, SBDC. System. I just, you know, want to thank you for supporting that organization. So we didn't give them any money. We gave them a network, and they love to work with each other. So it's kind of a neat thing altogether. The second question was relating to
an entrepreneur.
Yeah. So the way we kind of tagged the performance entrepreneurs were the ones who were serial in nature. So if they started a first company, second company, third company, I looked at the nature of how they bounced around. So literally, I take their biographical sketch, and I have a kind of an algorithm that pulls out each of the career steps. And the ones that are diverse, you know, I was a tech entrepreneur, and then I got into a services company, and then I did a nonprofit, and now I'm doing philanthropy. Those are really interesting people to me. But what I'm looking for are people that are kind of on an upward trajectory. And unfortunately, the U.S. is a country that does give people a second chance once you have one failure. But most of the breakout people that are the serial deal makers, the ones that have never really had much of a failure. If anything, it was maybe a neutral kind of event in their history. So I honestly think the entrepreneur is a self-initiated person, a person who gives themselves the permission to go do something, that aren't limited by some kind of overthinking process. They're usually ready, fire, aim kind of people. They're a little messy. That's why governments don't like to work with them, because they're like, well, these people are way out of line. But these are the people that make things happen and mix things up and, deal with their messiness and their complexity, and it's worth it, I love entrepreneurs.
Hi, I'm Wendy Takahisa. I'm with Morgan Stanley, one of those evil people you're talking about, although we do have a small business. I'm breaking the mic to boot.
Morgan Stanley is not
investment corp. We do have an impact SBIC, so we.
It's not evil.
We like to think we're one of the good guys. But I have a question about sort of, and it's kind of a chicken and egg question and cause and effect. So, all of the work that you did on where the entrepreneurs are, what causes them to be in Silicon Valley and Boston, and was that a naturally occurring phenomenon? Does success breed success that you can sort of? Why?
Yeah.
Can I piggyback on that?
Please.
Because New York was absent. And New York took some steps to amend its situation from a public policy standpoint, right? So
I intentionally extracted the financial capitals. So you didn't see Chicago, you didn't see New York, you didn't see Atlanta, you didn't see LA. But what we've learned is there's usually a source of advantage in innovation, and capital does play a role. I've been studying this, as a matter of fact. Money flies on planes. Two legs is killer. So if you have direct flights from a place that has investable capital, the places that are one leg away will generally be benefiting from those capital flows. So Philadelphia does pretty well because you're a train ride away from New York. Silicon Valley benefits Southern California and Seattle and Portland and Austin, all of which have one leg types of opportunities. And it's amazing how there's a correlation between the funded projects and the availability of equity capital. Now, venture capital is heavily weighted in California because it was started there in order to fund the silicon, generation, the initial semiconductors. It was a vehicle used to deal with the risk around building semiconductor companies. If you, by the way, I'd commend to you Andy Grove's blog. If you've never read Andy Grove's blog, Andy Grove's a CEO of and founder of Intel. It's the angriest, bitter, most bitter blog. He basically criticizes all of our entrepreneurs for not solving hard problems. He goes, "Look, I miniaturized what was a mainframe computer into mobile phones. What are you doing with Google? It's just search. What is that? It's fascinating. I would commend him. But back then he had a capital problem. Venture capital was there to fix it. Venture capital has persisted, but it's not really gone very far. It's a $50 billion asset class that kind of floats along. There's not been a major uptick except for in the year 2000 when it was exuberant. It's about four times that, and that was the bubble that everyone talks about. We're not having a venture capital bubble. I think we're not stupid enough. We do have a valuation bubble going on, and that will have some effect on us in the future.
Can I just kind of piggyback off that question, though, Ted? So, I mean, you mentioned Danny Grove, but Peter Thiel has this, this comment about how we wanted flying cars, and all we got was 140 characters. And I'm just curious what you think. Well, no question, three quarters of venture capital goes to three states, or goes to really California, New York, and Boston. What do you think about the broader ecosystem of entrepreneurship in the U.S. in terms of solving big problems, moonshot problems? Are we actually as entrepreneurial as we think we are? And if not, how do we change that?
It's funny. There's a whole dialogue working against the corporation now, and many of the big problems were problems that were solved by large organizations. If you think about NASA and the moonshot, literally. If you think about Intel as an entity, you think about how we moved to a mobile telecom, how we have done with medical devices and drugs. So I've been training my entrepreneurs to work very, very closely with larger companies. I think corporatization was a function of post-industrial order. And after World War II, we had to organize that way to deploy a lot of resources to build a lot of stuff. There wasn't a need to build like we had in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and it diminished. Now with the web, taking people to network-based communication strategies, large corporations are finding a role problem. And you're finding a bifurcated market between kind of the corporations that are becoming more holding companies and go-to-market distribution channels, and those that are truly innovating. The ones that are distribution are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed what's happening at Amazon? Have you looked at your credit card bill in the last 2 months? I mean, this is it. I was floored. I went to my wife on Tuesday, and I said, $4,000 in Amazon charges? What's going on? She goes, oh, it's much cheaper than Walmart. And I was like, wow, okay, I get it now. So distribution companies are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Innovation companies are usually a lot more targeted, and I'm worried that we're breaking them down too small. And unfortunately, we're not incenting with federal policy innovation. I think we need to do more to incent in the way that XPRIZE Foundation does. You know, doing a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal, get people to go solve huge problems. I'm teaching my students this right now. We're doing this session called Problems Worth Solving. And I was sick after 10 years of teaching entrepreneurship at UNC that I kept on getting pizza delivery businesses and, dating Facebook apps, you know. So I have six sessions. We're looking at energy, healthcare, applied science, engineering, poverty, food, and environment. And they're doing a map on the problems, and then they're going to solve it by building a venture in some way, some small part of the problem. So we're going to deal with relevant ventures. Get entrepreneurs to solve big problems.
Other questions from the audience?
Hello, Brett Barkley from the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. So we've talked a little bit about the geography of entrepreneurial networks in terms of between regions. I wonder if you can speak to the networks kind of within regions, and specifically, what do entrepreneurial networks look like in low-income areas, and how can capital be injected there as well? And also, to Braden, kind of, I'm curious, piggybacking off the question earlier on women and minority-owned businesses, is there any information on the zip code of businesses that Fundera has, of businesses that have used Fundera's site, and what does that potentially look like? We think about a lot about the geography of lending when it comes to home mortgages or otherwise, but it doesn't come up as much in small business lending, so I'm curious if you can speak a little bit more to that.
I wish we could curate the answer to this question, because I bet there are people in this room that could answer this question based on your ground level experience very well. We'd have to combine it. But I got to admit, I was very skeptical when philanthropy targeted Detroit for a turnaround, and I was wrong. But I will tell you that the type of innovation you're seeing in downtown Detroit, I ran the same data in Detroit, and there was nothing economically happening. But I was looking in a mirror. I was looking in the back rearview mirror at that point. I wasn't looking at stimulating optimism. And I got to say, empathy and optimism drives passion and encourages people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. And I think in many lower resource communities, I think people are just demoralized. So just creating a leadership effect where people are just willing to take a chance and willing to invest, and philanthropy, I think, needs to play a massive role in that activity just to get the ball rolling, stimulates a kind of a network, kind of a, what would I say, a flywheel that gets things going. But it's not been shared equally in Detroit, and that's the one thing that there's a lot of celebrated stories on what's happening in the revitalization of downtown, but there are parts of Detroit just as desperate as they've always been. So you have to attack some of the problems in different ways, problems with drug use, mental health, issues around education, a misfit between training and what the needs are in the private sector, stimulating private sector old school buffalo hunting to bring employers there. I got to tell you, I don't think the buffalo hunt's over, but you know, it's hard to find those buffaloes now. I've always been an enemy of a buffalo hunt, frankly. I say build it, don't buy it, but in some communities you have to stimulate it. So, you know, and try to bring your leaders together. I think the best thing to do is be democratic and bringing a diverse community together, communities of faith, communities that are in education, in different racial and socio-demographic patterns. Try to bring leadership across the board so it's a broad-based group participating in it. It's really hard work, And it's work y'all do, so you know, I only know a little bit about it.
Yeah, in terms of the zip code breakdown, so I mean, I'll be honest, I would love to do that, but it's off of 4,000 borrowers at this rate. Although I suppose you could say if you looked at those who were declined and didn't match with an option, it's going to be a multiple of about three times more than that. We've been talking with Barbara and Robin down in D.C. about how we can share our data to do more, to kind of empower Fed research and kind of remove a lot of the opacity that you guys have where you have to go out for survey because you might not have actual data on loans to small businesses. And it's something that I'd be more than happy to collaborate on with you guys. But I think at this rate, I mean, you're talking about 4,000 borrowers who've been funded through Fundera's platform. And yes, there's wide, you know, geographic diversity, but 14% to California, you know, 8% to New York. I would be surprised if, you know, if you're basing it off on a zip code basis, you're probably talking about, in some cases, 20, in other cases, like one borrower who was funded.
So
yeah.
You had the typology of zip codes.
Yeah, no question.
Low income zip codes in
yep.
general.
No question. I think what would be interesting to see, too, is in looking at that would be the kind of the rate breakdown, the credit score breakdown, the revenue breakdown, the rate breakdown, the type of product breakdown. These communities tend to get short-term loans that have the highest interest rates. That's what we looked at for women-owned businesses, for example, where when we were going through it, I think it's one page after the one I showed, but when you look at the revenue breakdown, when you look at the credit score breakdown, it isn't surprising that women are approved at a lower frequency overall. But what's telling is you look at the types of products they are approved for. And their APRs tend to be about 15 percentage points higher on average than men are. And the products they are approved for tend to be the shortest term products. And I think you'd probably find something similar when you're looking at kind of low income communities. But I'm happy to work with you guys on that.
We're at time. This has been a really rich session, and I hope that the dialogue continues outside of these walls. Thank you, everyone, for your hearty participation.